You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're going to find out what it's really like when your heart stops beating and you get the electroshock defibrillator paddles and the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
I love you.
Tom Cruise is out.
And it's a beautiful woman performing CPR. So it's true to form.
Yeah.
Come on, baby.
Boom, he's up.
Safe.
Grabs his gun. Turns out life after death is different than in the movies. Wait for that. Clinically, about 3.8 million people die every year around the globe out of hospital when they experience sudden cardiac arrest. About 10% of those people are then brought back to life. They walk among us, the undead. One of them is a guy I know. I actually used to work for him. My first real job in media was working as a humor columnist for Saturday Night Magazine, a venerable Canadian publication which itself died and was resuscitated three or four times. It passed for good about 23 years ago. The editor-in-chief of Saturday Night Magazine, when I was there, was a guy named Matthew Church. Matthew had a long career as a writer and editor. From 2004 to 2011, he was board chair for the Toronto Public Library. Matthew Church was the editor of Canadian Wildlife magazine. One December night in 2014, he died from sudden cardiac arrest. And Matthew Church joins me in our Toronto studio in a minute. Wait for it. What's your name and what do you do?
My name is Matthew Church and I'm a writer and editor.
Hi, Matthew.
Hi.
How did you die?
Well, I'm told, because it was all obliterated by my memory, but I'm told that I was returned home from cycling. I continue to be an avid cyclist, and I'd go for these long night rides. I got home, it was mid-December 2014. And I got home and I'm told that I was complaining of sore wrists and elbows, which is an unusual thing. And my wife, who is a doctor, said, you know, do me a favor, just take an aspirin. Just in case it's something else, take an aspirin. So I'm told I took an aspirin. And then I grabbed my stuff and went upstairs to watch TV on the third floor. And my wife and our dog stayed on the main floor in the living room sitting beside the fire. And she said a couple of minutes later, she heard a thump. Like I dropped a bag of books or something. And she knew that when I was upstairs watching TV, I wore headphones, so there's no point in calling up. I mean, she's a bit of a worrier, but she put that aside and said, you know, obviously it was nothing. And about a minute, maybe a minute and a half later, she's not sure, our dog, who's generally completely unaware, started going nuts. So the dog was beside her on the main floor, sitting at the, you know, beside the fire, and suddenly it started going nuts and barking, jumping up and going back and forth, and essentially compelled Patricia to get up and go upstairs. And it was like Lassie, practically. So Zola, sort of running, barking, leads her and follows her, joins her as she goes to the third floor. I guess Patricia arrives on the third floor and finds me dead on the floor. I'm blue, my lips are blue, and clearly my heart is not working. Luckily, as I say, she's a psychiatrist, and only that, or a physician, but she works in a hospital, so she's constantly trained on CPR and stuff. So she knew exactly what to do, which was, you know, to call for my daughters, who were luckily both home, and I suppose also unfortunate because they were exposed to this. They called 911, and Patricia rushed over to me, you know, flipped me over and started performing CPR. She She said it's the longest 7 minutes, 45 seconds of her life. And that's how long it took from the phone call to the ambulances, etc. It was like this flotilla of emergency vehicles that arrived at our house and charged up the stairs and went about restarting my heart. They told my wife, asked my wife to leave so she wouldn't be a witness to it. You know, they performed CPR and bagged me and then attached an AED and gave a shot. Nothing happened. Gave another shot. Still nothing. And the third shot, they got a little bit of a pulse, and then they set to. And they got me, you know, as quickly as possible. At that point, they rush you out to get you into an ambulance and whisk you off. So I gather they were there for some length of time. I was obviously totally oblivious to this, and I have no memory of it. My memory for the three previous days and two or three days subsequent is gone. I have no recollection of any of it. You know, it was a very dramatic and an incredible moment, but it was all dumb luck. Like the only, it's my dog intervening, but it's a matter of luck, really, that I'm sitting here talking to you now.
And you don't remember anything?
Nothing. It's retroactively, well before the event and well after the event.
Come on, man.
No. I really wish. In fact, I was toying with the idea of doing hypnosis or something to dig it out. And people said, no, don't bother. There's no memories that were implanted, were created. There's nothing to...
following the light, no life flashing before your eyes.
Not that I know.
Grandparents in white robes or hellfire or...
Nothing, and I think that really
great sense of calm, peace. The experience was like just a blackout for you?
It's hard to describe it as a blackout. It rather seems like just an absence, like it's a lacuna in my life, that simply didn't happen. So it sort of reinforces the idea of death in a way for me, that I wasn't there. And so why would I remember it in a sense? And it's very unsettling to have that sort of black area in your life,
I guess it suggests that you didn't come back with any stories of white tunnels or pearly gates, but...
You know, that would have been devastating. That would have killed me. If I had gotten that far and it said, there are pearly gates, I would have said, oh, no, not really, after all these years of not believing.
Yeah, it's the old Steve Martin joke where, like, everything you learn, like, you show up at the pearly gates and you say, well, a f***ing philosophy course was a waste of time.
Yeah.
But you actually maybe do have some answers, because if you hadn't been resuscitated, then we do know what happens, which is nothing.
Well, I don't think I'm a particularly reliable reporter from the other side, because I have nothing to report, So whether that's indicative of the reality or I can't say, but I'm working according to that principle.
Is that heartening? Is that reassuring, or are you a little bummed?
Well, like I said, I would have been devastated if I'd found out that there was an afterlife.
You say that very certainly.
Yeah. You know, what does Hitchens describe it as? North Korea, divine North Korea? You have to go to a place where someone else is going to tell you what it means to be happy.
Right.
But no, I'm comfortable with the confines of this life.
That's your assumption, is that lights out?
Yeah, worm food.
What is the medical explanation? You're not just a healthy guy, but an athletic guy. How long was this bike ride before this happened?
Well, it was sort of a standard ride, which is about an hour and a half. I was riding, I'd go out for these long, vigorous rides, and I'd sort of go to different, hills and work. And my whole thing was really sort of punishing exercise. I'm not a serious cyclist, but I was serious about getting my, maximum benefit from these
rides.
You say
nighttime ride, what do you mean?
9 o'clock till about 11, and I would go for rides and just zip all over the city and not know where you're going.
So what's the medical diagnosis? You got home, you had a vigorous cardiovascular workout, you had pain in your extremities, you took an aspirin that thins the blood.
That saved my life.
And that saved your life.
Well, everybody then said, that's the beginning of your good luck. When your wife said that, that was the beginning of your good luck.
What does that do that saves your life?
The idea is that aspirin thins your blood.
Yes.
So you've heard, people take what used to be called a baby aspirin, like a half dosage aspirin, just as a means of keeping your blood a little thinner. So anytime you encounter somebody, you think they're having a heart attack, the first thing you do is say, take an aspirin if you're not allergic. take an aspirin because it just thins the blood and reduces the likelihood of a heart attack or the severity of the heart attack that you have.
Because the thicker the blood, the more likely you're going to have...
Yeah, I guess. I mean, this just enables things to flow more freely.
I'm picturing a pump is going to do better with water than...
Yeah.
Than mud.
Yeah. No, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a given that this is what you do. The explanation for my event, it's technically called a STEMI, but that just describes the chart that you see on an EEG where it's an STR elevated. What it indicates is that the LAD, the left anterior descending artery, which is the one that wraps around your heart and actually is the one that's feeding the blood to the heart, got 100% blockage suddenly. And what that means is the heart can't function. So unlike different types of heart attacks that are blocking heart going out or blood going in or out, this is actually indicating that the heart itself is not getting blood. And then it's just a matter of time before it's going to stop and fail. And that's caused by blockage. You know, in my case, it was plumbing. Very often, the two main causes of sudden cardiac arrest are either the plumbing or electrical, effectively. So there's a failure in the electrical impulses or there's a blockage. And mine was a blockage. And the blockage of the LAD is called the widowmaker because you drop dead. And if it's unwitnessed,
that's it. And you had no previous heart disease?
No. My greatest risk factor, though, is heredity. I had a long history of grandparents on both sides who dropped dead. My father had an amazing story involving a heart attack. He had us at 48 in the mid-70s. And he was in total denial, which made it way worse. So that the second one was way worse and was catastrophic. But all conventional medicine failed my father. He couldn't take the drugs. The bypasses were failing. And it was, compared to today, it was like rudimentary care, you know. Mm-hmm. Sort of open heart meant opening up the chest and rooting around. Essentially, 5 years after his event, his doctor said, there's nothing I can do for you. And he lived another 38 years.
Oh, wow.
By dint of his will to change who he was, to become somebody different, you know, less driven, less tense, willing to share his feelings, that sort of thing. But he did, because he was so driven, he went out and sought the alternative caregivers, the people out there who were at the edges.
Which was uncharacteristic for him, I take it.
At that time, yeah. He was a very bold guy, but not in that kind of way. But he was just driven. He was a driven man. And he took that drive and ambition and will that caused his heart attack probably in the first place, you know, this single-mindedness. And he turned that into a pursuit of getting better. So but what's so cool was he was meeting the people and beginning to do, he was doing the things that were just beginning, seeking out these people that are now the convention. The Toronto Rehab Center does what my father was on the ground floor of.
So like statins and stents and bypasses didn't do it for him. So he took his ambition and purposed it towards like, I'm going to become the dude.
Yeah.
I'm going to become a chill dude.
Yeah. So, and it was phenomenal to watch because here was this hard-driven businessman who became a flake in a sense. You know, he was vegetarian. He was studying philosophy. He was meditating. He was doing yoga. He sought out Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was just beginning the mindfulness program in Boston, you know, and he's the sort of the father of the medical mindfulness movement in North America. And my father was on the ground floor with him, and there was another guy out west in California associated with Esalen, and it was
sure.
All about sharing feelings and stuff like that.
The Mad Men scene at the end where Don Draper goes off.
There you go.
The first hippy-dippy kind of, that was sort of modeled after.
Yeah.
Esalen.
Yeah, no, exactly. And there were people there were talking about it's all about your feelings and stuff. And my father got into all of this stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so he embraced all of these alternative technologies or approaches that when I had my event years later, but only 7 years later than my father had his, in terms of my age versus mm-hmm. his age, all of those things were the convention. You know, the Toronto Rehab Center, I was immediately enrolled in it. And I sought out a mindfulness program at the Toronto General Hospital, you know, which was run for survivors, effectively. My experience is totally different from my father's in the sense that I had zero implications afterward. And it was not long. It was about 6 weeks before I found out. I had no damage to my heart to speak of. There was great concern about brain damage. I'd been blind for probably 12 hours during this process, which I gather was very upsetting to me.
Wait, how do you know?
You know, everybody else who was there was watching me freak out because I couldn't, you know, I was blind. I couldn't see.
When you came back to life?
Yeah.
What was that like? I guess you can't give me a firsthand account.
Unfortunately.
What was it like for everybody else to see you? When you came back to life, what did you do? You came back to life blind.
Utter confusion and a complete lack of short-term memory. So I came to in the hospital and said, what's going on? And my wife very gently said, well, this is what's happened. And I had a particular reaction, you know, overwhelmed, I think, probably. And then 5 minutes later, I looked at her and said, wait, what am I doing here? What am I doing in the hospital? And she had to do it again. And I went through the same reaction again. Turns out this happened for the next 2 or 3 days, you know, or maybe a little less than that, but something like that. And I had two standard reactions. And it was either making a joke about it or expressing my frustration at how hard I'd worked to avoid having a heart attack, as my father's example, and yet had had one. So it was this sort of rote responses repeatedly. And I think they were getting increasingly agitated, increasingly concerned. If I didn't have blood to my brain for that length of time, what was the brain damage going to be?
Well, that's the worry when somebody has not had blood to their brain, is that there's brain damage.
Yeah.
And here you are, not remembering anything and asking the same questions again and again.
So they're freaking out, essentially, and not finding my humorous response particularly funny, I don't think, when I kept saying it over and over. But, you know, gradually that resolved. There was a really tense period, because this middle of December it happened, and it wasn't until close to the end of January until I had the follow-up appointments. So I had this sort of Christmas period and into the new year, where I really had no idea what my future was going to be. I didn't know. I was a bit enlisted in the neuro stroke clinic to see everything, to find out how bad the damage was. And we had to wait till everything had settled down before they could assess my heart and what the damage had been to my heart, because the likelihood is tremendous muscular damage.
Because it scars up really quickly, right?
Not only that, but, you know, anytime you deprive any muscle of oxygen, it's going to be damaged. So
I want you to slow down a minute. First of all, they didn't appreciate your humor.
No.
Was that just a tough crowd thing? Were they being fair? Like, do you remember any of your jokes?
I think it wasn't so much a tough crowd as I really didn't get my audience at that moment. Like, these people were freaked out.
Was the material any good?
The material was polished. It was good. You know that great George Burns line? You remember he said, glad to be here or something. And he said, but at my age, I'm glad to be anywhere.
Right.
And it was sort of like, that was my tagline for a while.
And you're never going to get a greater setup for that joke.
Right. And for about a year, I could say, someone said, well, what do you have? I said, well, I died in December. But, you know, other than that, not much has changed.
I don't feel like they were necessarily fair with you.
Like, wow.
I think a pity laugh.
I think at the very least, a pity laugh.
I want to back up to the moment where you were brought back. I'm not a medical doctor, but I've seen a lot of movies.
Yeah, emergency shows and things.
Does it upset you to see depictions of this?
No, I'm fascinated. I'm quite fascinated. I am extraordinarily emotional.
Oh.
And this is very common amongst survivors, apparently. Suddenly they become emotionally labile in a way. And I saw it in my father as well. I didn't recognize it at the time.
Is it unwelcome to play a clip from Mission Impossible 3, the CPR scene?
Oh, it won't bother me, I don't think. Let's see. Maybe I'll burst into tears. I haven't seen it.
I love you.
Tom Cruise is out.
And there's a beautiful woman performing CPR. So it's true to form.
Yeah.
Come on, baby.
Now you're supposed to do 30 compressions and then 2 breaths. So she's not quite doing it. And
no.
She's supposed to be doing it to the rhythm of Staying Alive by the Bee Gees. Look, she's giving up.
There we go.
Oh, she's pounding his chest.
You're not supposed to just hit them in the chest repeatedly?
No. Not unless you know what you're doing.
We're on the edge of our seats here.
She's not pushing hard enough for him to really make it.
Boom! He's up.
He's safe.
Grabs his gun. I think in the next scene, he's back on an airplane, jumping from airplane to airplane or something like that.
Right.
More or less what happened to you?
Yeah, pretty much the same. Yeah. I have yet to jump from an airplane, but, you know, it's funny. They tell you to get up and get exercising, but you lose all faith in your body.
I still want to stay right there in the hospital. You've been resuscitated. They don't say get up and get exercising right now?
No, not right away, but almost immediately. And I've done a ton of research, and it's really interesting. It was actually just in the 70s that really embraced, or late 60s, embraced the idea of the walking cure. Before that, if somebody had a heart attack, you lie in bed, you know, don't go up and down stairs, don't exert yourself at all. Try not even to, like, exert yourself on the toilet. Like, just don't exert yourself ever and lie there, which, of course, was, like, the worst possible thing. Your heart's just atrophying. Your entire body's atrophying. You're becoming depressed and fearful. It turns out the best possible cure is exercise, is getting you moving according to what you're capable of.
The muscle, and you need to work. You need to work to exercise that muscle.
Yeah, and that was a revelation. And it was an Irish guy who was drummed out of Ireland, who ended up in Toronto, a guy named Terry Cavanaugh, who really created this walking cure. And he's the founder of this rehab program that is now massive and award-winning. And he made his fame in the 1973 or 4 Boston Marathon.
Uh-huh.
He had 4 of his patients, I think it was, compete. And they all drove down, and he bought an old hearse, and they all drove down in a hearse. And it was like, you know, 4 dead guys participating in the marathon. I was extremely lucky in another sense that downtown Toronto, you know, as I mentioned, like, the full complement of the most advanced medical care arrived at my door within 8 minutes.
Yeah, the response time, I was thinking when you told that story, that's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. And not only, I don't remember the ambulance trip, but it passed 2 hospitals and went to a 3rd hospital, because that 3rd hospital had a clinic that's dedicated to reperfusion of the heart after a STEMI heart attack like I'd had. So there's a whole protocol.
Let's give them a shout out. Which hospital is that?
Yeah, that was TGH, Toronto General Hospital. And the shout out to the paramedics.
Yeah.
You know, because they recognize this particular pattern on the ECG and say, okay, we have to take him to this place. And
that's got to be a good day as a paramedic, like bringing somebody back to life. That's got to be.
You know, it's a funny thing. A year after he restarted my heart, this fellow named Dean Smith, a paramedic, I sought him out. You have to go through paramedic service, and, you know, there's privacy issues, and he may not want to meet me or whatever. But he agreed to. So it was literally a year later to the day that I went and shook his hand. And it was at an ambulance station far from our house, and had a lovely conversation with him. He seemed like a really lovely guy. But one of the things that was most striking to me is, after 17 years in service, this was the first time anybody had sought him out to say thank you. And I just thought that would have been, like, an essential. Like, people, I felt driven to do this, not only to say thank you, but just to shake his hand and meet him.
You might be a better person than everybody else.
I don't think so.
Dean Smith might have otherwise not been a very good paramedic.
Yeah, maybe that's success. Or... I don't think that's the story. It gave me real insight into the life of a paramedic, though.
Yeah.
Incredibly stressful, and you're dashing off madly to, you know, what in most cases are false alarms. And they have so few real successes.
Yeah, and they see people in these moments of trauma. You know, what I think it probably is that there's a trauma response to get away from the danger. And those moments where you encounter paramedics, like, there's a strange, even when I think about, like, a cycling accident where I needed stitches, or, like, I can't remember the faces of the people who helped me.
Yeah, and so here's the interesting thing. There's no follow-up for them either. Like, they don't find it. And that's very frustrating, because it is so traumatic for them, as you say. And yet you have no way of knowing whether it was a positive outcome or not. And in my case, like, such a positive outcome. He would have assumed that maybe I had brain damage or my life would be limited afterward. So to just walk over from my house to visit him was, I think, was sort of telling for him. And it's related to the fact that whoever is performing CPR, if somebody on a street corner steps forward, a bystander steps forward, and eventually an ambulance arrives, they're pushed aside, step back, please, and no one knows their name.
Yeah.
They never find out what happened, and they're left with trauma. There's a whole system now. What we're talking about now is this aftermath is support for the survivor, support for the family if there isn't a survivor, support for the family if there is a survivor, because suddenly everything's going to be very different for them.
How so?
Oh, you know, they may have witnessed, they may have seen their loved one lying there, their dad or their partner.
Blue. Dead.
And then people pounding on their chests and beating on them and the trauma and the dogs barking, going nuts and the whole thing.
So how about your daughters and your wife? Did they have, I'm sure they had to deal with.
Yeah, they had a lot to deal with. And the fact that Patricia is a psychiatrist was extremely helpful, I think, in supporting everybody. But we were very fortunate again in that way, whereas most people don't get that. Most mm-hmm. people don't have that.
You made a full recovery?
Yes. It's considered miraculous. My family doctor described it as a miracle, which is a little unsettling when your doctor starts talking about miracles.
You're cycling again.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, very quickly, soon after. Once I got over the fear of my own heart.
That must be like just not being able to trust your body or...
Exactly.
It came out of the blue. So you like...
Yeah, it was totally out of the blue. I guess I'd thought about it a lot because of my father, but it was completely out of the blue and I was totally unprepared. I thought I'd done everything I could to avoid it. And yet it's the most interesting thing that's happened to me.
Do you have resuscitation buddies? Do you have like friends who've been through the same thing?
There's some fantastic, dramatic stories. There was one guy, this guy in Vancouver I met. There was a study that came out that said that if you live above the 12th or 13th story of an apartment building or condo, your likelihood of survival of a heart attack drops significantly. It's just the likelihood of getting help and getting out.
Yeah.
And so this guy had just read this in one of the Vancouver papers. There'd been a report about it. And he went home and he got on the elevator. And he realized on the elevator that he was having a heart attack. Right? And he's riding up to his 20th story apartment or whatever. And he gets to the top.
See, that's funny.
It is funny. He gets to the top and he realizes he's having a heart attack. And he presses the down button.
Yeah.
He doesn't get off. He presses the down button. When the door is open at the bottom, he's lying on the ground unconscious or dead.
Yeah.
And someone finds him and resuscitates, you know, calls and does the right thing and steps up. And so there's an example of a research report directly saving somebody's life.
Right.
So that's a cool story. I love that story.
What should I do? I have a family with heart disease up and down, both sides.
Yeah.
My grandfather died before I was 1 year old. I'm told that I walked at his funeral. He was 64, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
And my dad says he missed major advancements in bypass surgery that could have given him another 30 years.
Yeah.
If he'd had his heart attack a year or two later.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't. He dropped dead. I don't cycle up grueling hills. I'm a bigger guy than you. I had two different pastries today at lunch, in lieu of lunch. I don't know CPR.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you even begin?
Well,
giving me advice.
The first thing I would say is make sure your partner knows CPR.
Yeah, I guess that would be.
I used to say, what advice would you get? People would ask me. I'd say, well, marry a doctor. Get a dog and marry a doctor. That was the secret to my survival.
Yeah.
But seriously, there's multiple causes of cardiac arrest. Heredity is a primary predictor, so you have a significant risk factor there. Stress is another one. How one deals with stress is really the issue. Here's an interesting fact, if I may, about CPR. They changed the protocol about 5 years ago, and said breaths were no longer necessary. Just do the compressions. Just beat on the chest. Don't interrupt those for the sake of a breath.
Uh-huh.
And that was like a big change, you know? But the rationale wasn't because of better outcomes. The rationale was you're more likely to have people become involved if they don't have to put their mouth on the mouth of a stranger. So it's better to have a lesser form of CPR performed than none at all.
So it's still better to do mouth to mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But because people, they're afraid of cooties.
Yeah, which is totally human, right? Like if you see you don't want to go up and block, you know, this is a stranger and they may be, you know, they may be a street person. They may be whatever. And people are loath to get involved, let alone to put their mouth
on
it.
Sure. So you take that out of the equation and then a lot more people will help.
That's the idea.
I don't know if you could relate, but if you are a manager of journalists, they can be difficult people.
I think the stress was a huge part of my problem.
Mm-hmm.
So a big part of my recovery has been Vipassana, insight meditation. And that was a big part of my father's survival. I saw him doing it and I recognized that was a very powerful modality in terms of dealing with stress, but also dealing with the fact that you died, coming to terms with many things. There's a really interesting branch of Buddhism based in Bhutan that maintains that the key to happiness is being always aware of your own mortality. So back to my advice to anybody.
Meditation and Buddhism.
No, Buddhism is not the thing. Meditation of any kind, it can be breathing exercises. Yeah. And the breath is this very powerful tool for maintaining your health. And a modicum of exercise. So they say, what do they say, 150 minutes a week, four times a week, you know, total of four times a week. That's manageable. That's you walking to work from home.
What about philosophical